The old public television comedy series Red Green, which aired from the early 90s into the mid-2000s, did what struck me as a masterful job of poking fun at stereotyped images of what it is to be a man, especially in the rugged Canadian woods where the series was set. Talk of fishing, trucks, and duct tape, otherwise known as the handyman's secret weapon, abounds on the show. Each episode would end with the all-male cast gathering for the opening of the regular meeting of the Possum Lodge. They would bow their heads for the man's prayer. "I'm a man, but I can change. If I have to, I guess." Well, while it may be true that some things have changed since then, it seems to me that men, I'll just say especially white men like me, still have a lot of work to do. A lot of inner work. A lot of relational work. A lot of anti-racist and anti-misogynist justice work. A lot of maturing and transformation and vulnerability to embrace. A lot of posturing and armor to let go. As a son of my parents, husband to my spouse, father to two sons and a daughter, as a citizen of the planet, I'm a man and I can change because I both have to and want to. I'm Chris Johnson, welcoming you to another episode of Pause, Purpose, Possibility. My guest this week, Dane Anthony, explores with me some of the ways that change, growth, transformation can happen, and not only among men. Starting with questions like, how would you describe who you are without referring to your professional role or title? What might you need to unlearn in order to open doors and pathways of imagination to understanding yourself and your work in the world more deeply and with greater authenticity and joy? How might exploring new images of God or the holy in one's life open up access to one's unique soul print, the sliver or spark of the divine in each of us that invites our truest selves into lives of mattering and belonging? Dane's professional path focuses on facilitating conversations of meaning and purpose, helping others to explore the deeper connections that bring awareness and grounded practices to work and relationships. He has fostered engagement-centered leadership in the following contexts. More than 30 years in higher education as a university chaplain, a student services administrator, and as a faculty member. As a spiritual guide and mentor for more than 30 years through spiritual direction, vocational discernment, men's groups, and retreat leadership. And more than 20 years of experience teaching and consulting with the StrengthsFinder inventory for individuals and businesses. Dane earned his bachelor's from Missouri State University and his Master of Divinity from Midwestern Seminary. In addition, he holds certifications in spiritual direction. And my primary connection with Dane has been as a facilitator in the Circle of Trust retreat approach in association with Parker Palmer and the Center for Courage and Renewal. Dane has been married to Maggie for 30 years, and they have 3 grown children. Welcome to the conversation. My friend and colleague Dane Anthony is joining me today, and I'm just so thrilled for this opportunity to be with you. I have risked making Dane blush a bit by gushing to him about how important he has been in my life. He is has been a font of inspiration and wisdom and gentleness and warmth for a number of years that we've known each other as a fellow Courage and Renewal Circle of Trust facilitators under the umbrella of the work that Parker Palmer and the Center for Courage and Renewal have brought into the world. So we've had many occasions to be together in the same spaces, in person or virtual. And Dane has just struck me as somebody
in whose company I love to spend time. So I'm really glad that you are kind enough, Dane, to spend some time with me today in this setting. Welcome.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. Really. When you sent the email and asked about doing this, I was looking forward to blocking out the time because I used to enjoy being with you. And we seem to show up in these, we keep saying yes to the invitations that we're each receiving that puts us in shared spaces. And I'm always grateful for that.
Yes, we do.
There's
yes,
at
we
least
do.
One person I know that I'm going to be able to connect with when I get there.
So
grateful to be here.
Well, I'm grateful for you. Thanks for doing this. What would you like people to know about who you are or who you know yourself to be today at this point in your life on planet Earth early in 2024? Who is Dane? Who do you want people to know about?
Well, I come at that from two different perspectives. One, with the help of our shared friend, Wint, asked me a question a couple of years ago that's set me on a different trajectory with a question like that. I think traditionally I would answer it kind of from the description of roles that I've had in higher education for 30 plus years in varying roles of student affairs and university chaplaincy and faculty, been an entrepreneur, a spiritual formation oriented person as a spiritual director, certified with Circle of Trust through the Center for Courage and Renewal. Do a lot of work with StrengthsFinder inventory. Now I'm working in the facilitation area, primarily with men in either therapeutic contexts or leadership development coaching. So that's kind of the occupational, vocational dynamic. Married to Maggie. This will be 30 years this fall. Been married together. We have a blended family of three adult kids. We'll probably get to aspects of this. We just moved about 7 or 8 months ago out into the forest from being urban dwellers for a long, long time and adjusting to the beautiful invitations and challenges of living in the woods. I think the other way I might come to that, how would you describe the way you're engaged in your work if you didn't use a role or a title?
Mm-hmm.
And it was super challenging, Chris, because there's so much of what I just described that has role or title to it that isn't anywhere close to definitively describing the nature of the work, the presence in the work, the challenges, the gifts in the work. It's just this, I think, maybe a shallower level of description of this is what we call this thing we do.
Yeah.
Not here's the beauty or the challenge or the invitation of the work. Probably the majority of what you and I will now talk about will be more in line with questions that Wint posed of what has made up our lives in ways that have enriched us and challenged us, surprised us, things that have opened up doors or windows or pathways that we wouldn't have expected had we been thinking in a shallow sense of what this was supposed to do. Little tangential pathways I'm finding myself taking at the moment to respond to that is over the last probably 10 years, I've created this list, and it's a dynamic list. Right now, it's 12 or 13 words that I don't use anymore. And working to find language that feels truer to my experience of describing this thing than the ways in which culture has now altered its relationship to the understanding of the word. So words like control, I don't use the word control. I don't really think there is such a thing. I think we live with the illusion of control at best. So for me, the language of impact, influence, input, I think I have the ability to engage with influence and impact and input. I can't control my own thoughts most of the time. There's no way I could control someone else's reaction to something or the way they're going to do it. Should is on my list of words. It feels like a demand. It has lots of connotations to the way I grew up. Kind of really pedantic, kind of the ethos of the world I grew up in, religiously and family. A lot of finger wagging. I know better than you do, which led to a lot of mistrust of my own internal voice or the closing down of my internal voice. Like I didn't know. So I had to rely on external impetus or knowledge or expertise of someone else to know what I should be able to do, because I couldn't trust the inner sense of that. But we can get to other ones, but those are two that are way up at the top of the list when I started the list. I think when we get to this idea of vocation, there's a truth, there's a kind of a, in the best ways, a rightness to who we are each uniquely in the world. But I don't sense there's any longer do I sense that there's a should.
So I'm going to try on some language for size in response to what you just said, without, of course, intending to impose the language on you. So swat this away or nuance it as you need to. But what I was sensing or feeling in what you just said was that learning a willingness or a capacity to set aside primary emphasis on role and title, and in identifying words that you're not going to use anymore, there has been some unlearning that you've been doing. So that's one piece of the language I'm going to try on with you. Unlearning. And I also sensed you describing both a freedom from and a freedom for, or freedom to, that has emerged. So those are the other two pieces of the language I want to offer to just see how that lands with you. And first, if it does land, unlearning, freedom from, freedom for, or freedom to, what more can you say about how you've experienced those?
We could probably just stay on that and talk about that for a whole time together today.
Okay.
I think the idea of unlearning has really captured my attention in the best of ways last several years. I think some of it has to do with wisdom, some of it has to do with time and age and moving through. And some of the work that I do, we have in the past couple of years been talking about archetypal development process from warrior to lover, king to sage, or queen to sage. I think what I've recognized in doing that work is that we don't leave the warrior. I like to think of them more as energy than as just developmental things. If we don't leave the warrior and become a lover and are no longer in, like we're done with warrior energy, because that's like justice is all about warrior energy, like the rightness of something. We don't leave lover and become a king or queen. What we're doing when we're doing it well is we're assimilating and integrating the energies of all those as we move through them, accumulating what then the sage holds is the ability to know how and when and where to bring the energy of each of those to whatever they're present to. Doing that work has helped me recognize in the question about unlearning is unlearning so that I can learn in a new way. That's kind of how I like to think about it.
Yeah.
How I engage my warrior energy as a sage when it's time to step forward as the king, self-sacrificial king, not the tyrant king, to serve others outside of myself from this place of grounded truth. Or what does lover energy look like as an older person?
Mm-hmm.
Those are all really presiding questions for me. And a lot of that process has in it the process of unlearning either cultural definitions of what those things should look like or shouldn't look like. I think there's something about the nature of our work and the Center for Courage and Renewal that's very countercultural. No fixing, saving, advising, correcting, because warriors and kings often feel a need to do that. Well, a sage has a different perspective. Those are all the unlearning piece and the archetypal energy work have really melded themselves for me well in the last couple of years. And that feels like something I'm regularly having an internal conversation about, it often external in times and places like this. I think moving away from those archetypal places of only seeing them as through a developmental arc minimizes the ability of what those archetypal things can teach us. What does it look like for lover energy to engage itself in the world? I was noticing even your salutation and your email was peace and justice. that those two feel paradoxical and yet are absolutely necessary to exist together, because they serve as a counter, a necessary counter to each other. That's not a warrior lover perspective. Like it's you know, it's all peace for the lover, or it's all justice for the warrior. And it's like, maybe not right now. you know, which is the voice of a wise king or a sage. And yet all those things need to be present, and how we're learning to and unlearning what it's like to move in and out of the energy of those things for whatever the situation or the conversation that's in front of us is asking.
That's really rich. Thank you for that. And I'm glad that you noticed how I assigned my emails, peace and justice. Thank you for that. That brings to mind that I have noticed at the bottom of your emails in the signature space, am I right to recall that the name of a container for your work in the world is down there? Soul print. Do I have that correct? Soul print. I'm intrigued by that. What more can you say about what is signified by that language and well, about the container that it points to and the work that you do?
I had been sensing in my trajectory of leaving higher education, at least in the form that I was in, that I wanted to step into some broad or expansive idea of spiritual formation. So I had this idea of soul, also wanting to talk about the idea of the unique imprint of each of us, the divine imprint on us. This is just one of those wonderful synergistic things. I was pulling up to a traffic line at a stoplight, and there was an AT&T service truck in front of me, and it had a bumper sticker on it. And the O in whatever the word was, which I've since forgotten, was a fingerprint.
Oh.
And soul print just literally popped into my mind.
Yeah.
And so when you see it on my website, the O in soul is a thumbprint. Which is where the individual mark on each of us. You and I would have grown up in an era in which language like doing God's will in the world would have been very prevalent. And my experience with that growing up was that there was one thing God wanted you to do, and it was your job to figure it out and go do it. Which was a crazy lovely way to think about doing that. And I've always thought of it, even as a kid. I was a big Monty Python fan in high school. And putting the two of them together, it always felt like the search for the Holy Grail was this God's will thing, you know. And if you didn't find it, like what would that mean? And it's like the ultimate failure. You have your whole life to find this thing. You didn't find it. Like, so lots of fear about judgment day. And so I think what that's shifted into the last couple of years, I was sitting with a client a couple of years ago, and he was wondering about this dynamic for himself. I think he was in the process of unlearning what his version of all those things meant. And in the moment I said, well, it's like, I'd like to think of God's desire for us more than God's will. It feels more open and feels more resonant with how I experienced the divine. And I said, you know, it seems like when God dreamed up Chris and God dreamed up Dane, that God took a sliver of God's self and said, go be Chris in the world. Go be Dane in the world. And that God's desire for us is to be the most that. And that our work in the world is to learn as much as we can about that, engage it, and then the next morning get up and go look for more, which is also part of the unlearning piece too. Like unlearn what that means, some of what that means, to expand that idea of spirit forming us spiritually, is that there's this uniqueness that's ours, extrapolated over time in ways that it's like the more I bring that to the world, the closer we get to this idea of heaven. And that I do remember wondering with a friend once, it's like, if every one of us was engaged in what we believe to be true about that sliver in a moment of time, like, could the universe be any better than that?
Yeah, wow.
That would be the ultimate expression of all of our unique divinity in the world. Like there's nothing beyond that I could imagine that would be more to God's desire.
Everything you're describing really resonates with me and casts a whole new, deeper, richer, warmer light on the fact that the word vocation comes from the Latin root vocare, to invite. So speaking about God's desire or God's aspirations, God's dreams for us, rather than God's will, follow the direction, figure out the puzzle, or risk internal damnation. The things you're describing about desire and so on just fit so much more beautifully, I think, with that notion of our calling as being an invitation, something that tantalizes us and calls us forward and outward and inward and deeper. And how does that landing with you?
Absolutely. I think there's something about in that earlier understanding that I was given and try to live into and out of, that there was this one thing to do felt really limiting. Mm. I remember even as a mid-young teenager, just like, well, what if I don't like it? And like, well, what does that mean about my energy around that? I didn't have all that language then.
Yeah.
But it's like, what? And I think it, without knowing it, formed this idea, this image of God that I was in relationship with, is the language I like to use. This image of God that I was in relationship with, that made God kind of a tyrant, yeah. You know, like he was messing with me, yeah. Us.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to put this thing, I'm going to hide this thing out there, and you got to go find it. And I'm just going to kind of sit back and hope you get close. Oh, you're warm. No, you're cold. It just felt, it didn't feel kind, didn't feel invitational, didn't feel generous. All those things that I now experience, the presence of the holy. I really do believe, and I'd say this with folks that I work with often, I do believe that God comes to us with kindness and patience and gentleness and strength together, openness, expansiveness, all those things that astrophysicists are using about the universe, all those kinds of things. And so I think something I said earlier about expanding the idea of spiritual practice, we would have grown up calling them disciplines, which also is one of those words I don't use anymore.
Yeah.
I like practice is much better. Just feels like I have more room in a practice than I do in a discipline. That over the time of COVID, or just as COVID was beginning, there was something about the combination of solitude and movement together that become really important to me. And so fly fishing and kayaking and hiking and bird watching and gardening, all fit very easily in that idea of spiritual practice for me, because of the things that are engaging my heart, mind, my mind, mind, or my thinking mind, my body, mind, my spirit, in one place, in one time, in one experience altogether, which is not something historically that a spiritual discipline, in my experience, did for me. I was very much here most of the time, wanting, needing to do it right or not do it wrong, or the ways that I wouldn't even say engaged me, but dictated maybe more the way I was in it. So I think space and movement feel really true to the ways that I now see, quote unquote, what that means about the ways we move in the world and engage with each other.
Yeah, your mention of the fingerprint image as part of soul print brought to mind, I don't know that I can be specific, but I am having memories of encountering in let's say museum exhibits here and there across my lifetime, of shards of or whole pieces of pottery, clay pottery, that are, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of years old, on some of which you can still see the fingerprints of the potter. And that always just gives me such goosebumps that was a unique, never to be repeated human being that created this functional, beautiful object that now I get to interact with, even if it's on the other side of a piece of glass, whatever it might be, that there is something relational still happening there between the print, the imprint that artisan made thousands of years ago, and me and whatever life I'm living now, or ways that I'm making and leaving my prints on what I touch and who I touch and how I'm showing up in the world. So thank you for that reminder as well.
Yeah, and that's good. I like that. And it's like there's something beautiful about the divine invitation. I love your connection to that. That is, please put your mark on things. I've given you your own unique one. Please use it. Put it on things. That's not articulated itself that way until just this moment. But it's like, yes to that.
You mentioned, Dane, along the way that an important part of your work in the world these days, the imprint that you're making, is around men's leadership, spirituality, and so on. What more can you tell us about that? What the work looks like? Why it's important? Who are men these days? What do you sense that men most need to unlearn and live into instead? And I don't know. There is a bazillion directions you could go with teaching us everything there is to know about men.
I'm glad we only have like 30 minutes to do this.
Oh boy.
I could talk a little bit about the trajectory of what got me there. I had a decent relationship with my dad, but he was very removed. World War II vet, grew up in the Depression, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And I think there was something about wanting a connected relationship with him that in the ways that I was hoping for didn't ever materialize or happen, that there was always, I felt like a gap or a chasm between us relationally. I knew he loved me. He didn't use that language ever. I sensed he was proud of me, but he didn't use that language either. So I never heard him say those things to me, although I sensed it was true. And so it left me in a really confused state. I've named that dynamic oppositional energy. And the idea of that is that I then, as I was raising my daughter, wanted her to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I was proud of her and loved her. And at 6 years old, one day, we're sitting at a traffic light. A lot of things happened for me at traffic lights. we were sitting at a traffic light and I was just like going on, Caitlin, I love you so much. I'm so proud of who you are. And she looked at me. She said, Daddy, you don't have to tell me you love me all the time. And I think what I created in that, or what I came to know in that, that I've called oppositional energy, is that I was responding to her, trying to create an experience for her that was the opposite of mine.
Yeah.
And yet I created the same kind of confusion that I had with my father, because I was telling her more than she needed to know. She already knew that. And my need to tell her more than she needed to know was all about me, not about her.
Wow.
And it was all about the vacancy of what I was still carrying from my father. And I wasn't trying to be her father. I was trying not to be my dad.
Yeah, right.
And so I think then the question that emerged out of that for me is, well, then how do I parent her?
Yeah.
If it's not being against my father, that set me on a whole new trajectory into like, what does it mean to be one me? And what does it mean to be a man that's not living purely as a opposite or negative reflection of one's own father? That was commensurate time-wise with a lot of the work that I was stepping into with younger college students, mostly men. And I started doing these, I called them doing life groups, and I would invite half a dozen young men and we'd meet once a week for a semester. We just talk about stuff. I'd bring books or quotes or passages of scripture sometimes, and we would just have open conversation about it. And I did that for quite a while. And I think I was working out some of my own desire to find connection, masculine connection, and introduce a different way of being engaged in that than I had experienced before. I'm now doing work with men who are far younger than my children, as well as men who are about my stepson's age, mid-40s, and some men who are around my age who are just now beginning to step out of kind of late warrior, early king mode and thinking about what legacy. And so I think you and I would resonate with like threshold language. Like I think I'm working pretty constantly with people who are in some form of transition, whether they realize that or not. I think it's, I use this phrase in a call this week, straddling the threshold. One foot in one understanding of myself, another foot just stepping across into some new territory. And there's something about that space, Chris, that I think is so true to and for all of us. And we may be doing that in 6, 8, 12 ways and places in our life about different things. We may be at a certain kind of threshold with a child. We may be with a spouse. We may be with vocation. We may be in community, maybe with ourselves. And thinking of transition not as just these epic things like graduation or marriage or birth of a child, or the fact that you and I transitioned from other things this morning into this conversation and soon will transition out into other things, that there are these kind of more epic cultural kinds of transition experiences. And they're very, do you know the word quotidian?
I know it exists. But
it's like this fancy word for the common everyday.
Yeah.
I find so ironic that we have this really fancy word that describes something that's really common. But I think we're probably experiencing more quotidian transitions in our day, or literally walking through a doorway, literal transitions from one space into another more often than we're aware. Like if I sat here for a moment and thought about, I've probably crossed at least a dozen literal thresholds this morning. Figuratively, maybe even more. And might each one of those, if I slow down, be asking me something? I think that's probably true. And we can't orient our life around stopping at every single one. Like, what is this asking of me? Which is a profound question that I carry with me all the time. I might get to that one. What is this asking of me? Well, I don't have the time to do that right now. Or maybe it's not much.
What's your sense of what is being asked of, let's narrow it down, to men in the 21st century United States these days? So, you know, without asking you to be entirely global, in the culture that is going to be inhabited by most of the people listening to this podcast, what is it that's being asked of men these days?
Well, I can speak directly only to the ways that I'm encountering that in my work. And I do recognize that each of us has a need to matter and belong. I think those are innate human needs. I would venture to say, not every single thing, but most of what we're doing in our lives, the decisions we're making, the choices we're making, are oriented around helping us determine one or both of those things.
Mattering and belonging.
Mattering and belonging.
Okay.
And so I think what our culture, Western consumer culture, has created is a way to define or answer those questions through a particular performance-based kind of idea for men.
Yeah, right.
And so then we would describe ourselves as going back to the very first question you asked me, we would primarily describe ourselves through a role or a title. That's not bad or wrong. I just think it's narrow, small. Many of the men that I'm working with, particularly very late 30s to 40s, sometimes not until later 40s, is they keep trying to answer those need questions through their work as their primary identity. And the work isn't designed to answer those questions. The work is designed to just be done. But we're layering on top of that, then these really much deeper, expansive kinds of questions, like, do I belong or do I matter? And so then the next project or the next promotion or the next whatever has to also carry the weight of those questions in ways that the work is not designed to do that. Even the deep spiritual soulful work that we do isn't fully designed to carry that. And so then there's a certain point for men. It's not 100%, but it's pretty darn high, is that they exhaust all of their resources trying to address those two questions through their work until the point where they reach the end of all their personal resources. Like, they just don't have enough left in them to keep saying yes to this trajectory. And often that leads to some kind of disruption, an affair, or whether it's getting fired when they didn't see it coming, or whether it's the economy and the work that they chose now doesn't create or support the life that they felt like they needed or built, and they come to the end of themselves.
Some of those men, just good old fashioned burnout or
yes,
breakdown.
Absolutely. Yeah. Midlife crisis.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's right. Some of those men I'm discovering have enough of a curiosity left in there to look outside of themselves for something that's more than what they've been engaged with. That often, and I'm recognizing, means that they can come back to their work differently, the same work, they can come back to it differently without having the work carry the burden and the weight of those big questions, because they've learned there's another way in their life, another place in their life outside of their work, or to be in their work differently that can address those, that isn't so shallow or narrow or small. That's kind of where I'm in the leadership development work that I'm in right now. That's kind of where we're teaching men about how to be with their feelings and express their feelings. Like, oh, when you said that, I felt really sad.
Yeah.
Tell me about your sadness. It's like, man, the work I do is so low. Can we talk about the loneliness of leadership?
Yeah.
It's just inherently lonely. It's like, where do you take, and to whom do you take the issues or the problems that you're carrying as a leader? You can't take it to the guy who's just stepped in the door, you know, at an entry level thing. So what do you do with the loneliness in a way that actually helps expand you and open you up and teach you about yourself, helps you unlearn patterns? There's something about that that's just really a rich place. I'm finding more and more. I don't need, and I think what the sage piece is helping me understand is, I don't have to know the work that you do and be an expert on your kind of work as a commercial real estate person or an investment banker to be able to connect with you as a human being in the experience of fleshing out these questions of belonging and mattering.
So rich and wise and luminous as I knew it was going to be. Thank you, Dane. And I sense that there are horizons extending in lots of directions that we could keep going for a very long time. But as the poet, somebody also said, all good things need to come to an end. So as we turn the corner in that direction, one of the things that we've been trying to weave in near the end or at the end of each of the episodes of the podcast so far is to offer folks who are kind enough to listen, maybe a what I think of as a big question or two that they can take with them to help them to continue to reflect on what it is that they've heard throughout that episode. And then also a practice. Thank you for using that language earlier, practice instead of discipline. Big question or two and a practice to take with them, again, to help folks to deepen and extend what their experience of the episode has been. So at the risk of putting you on the spot, does anything come to mind or heart for you that you would like us together to invite our listeners today to ponder, to reflect on as questions and or as a practice?
Sure. Well, I think the one that I mentioned a little bit ago that has been for me the most significant question to engage, and it could be about something what I would perceive to be small or something really significant, and what is this asking of me?
Yeah, okay.
Which I think is a question we can live into for the rest of our lives, because there's always this, whatever this, or who this is. It's a decision, it's a relationship, it's an idea, even a beautiful idea that comes to mind. It's like, wow, what is this asking of me? Not in this burdensome kind of way, but out of curiosity and wonder and possibility.
It feels very invitational.
Pause, purpose, and possibility. Yeah, this is the title of your podcast.
Yep.
So I think that there's a way to carry that question, like the poet Rilke would talk about, what does it look like to live the question as a place of just consideration? Like, how do I consider the idea of this question? Not in a like super heavy, weighty, burdensome kind of way. That would be the question for me. And this is the practice is kind of a practice and a question also. In my spiritual direction work, I've been engaging people around articulating the image of God that you're currently in relationship with. Because the image of God that you're currently in relationship is dictating a lot of your quote unquote spiritual conversation. And is that image of God? It's not the God, it's an image of God that you have. How is that dictating the way that you're with yourself and in the world? It might offer you an opportunity or an invitation to unlearn parts of that relationship. As I've said to a couple of people, maybe it's time to go find a new God, because this one's really small. The image of this God that you're in a relationship with is keeping you really stuck. Or, it's like, if God's really angry at you for not doing certain things, is that's being in a relationship with an image of God that isn't, it's certainly not God. And it would be very limiting and keep you stuck, which is not what I think God is saying relationships about. That might feel like a big practice, but it's borne a lot of fruit for me and created a lot of freedom, to go back to your earlier statement, a lot of freedom and space.
Yeah. And opportunity, possibility to live into in response to invitation, summons, calling. Wow. That's what I'll be saying to myself about this conversation for a long time to come. Wow.
Thank you
so much, Dane.
Yeah, this is really rich. I'm glad I went and had that big country boy breakfast this morning. So I had lots of energy and plenty of protein, apparently, to engage with you about this. Is
beautiful. Great. Well, again, thank you so much, Dane. Thank you, Dane.
Thank you.